From AXDRW, this is Henry Monsters. From KCRW, this is Henry Monsters.
From KCRW, this is Hear Me Monsters.
Why do you think it's hard to get voice right?
Oh.
You know, what is it? What is it about voice that makes it tricky? Is it just that there's been more attention paid to the visual element of it? Or is synthesizing like realistic voice actually harder than synthesizing real images?
When it comes to speech recognition, there are so many aspects of speech that you have to take into account, which is differentiating between the human voice and other sounds in the vicinity. Like, it's much more high-dimensional set of features that you're trying to tackle and that you're trying to encapsulate into a single output.
Could you introduce yourself, Anjali?
I am Anjali Zuparis, and I am a clinical data scientist based in the Netherlands.
I'm so glad that you're helping me with this, Anjali, because you helped me out a lot with that data set last season. So I'm very grateful for you walking me through some of this.
It's my pleasure.
I forgot to send you this last night. I'm going to send you an audio file real quick. I could not handle this last night when I listened to it.
Hen is dobbered much later, wishing he didn't.
What is deep learning, Anjali? What is deep learning?
I'm trying to figure out how to explain this without including the mathematics. But how about this? Here's an example. So let's say you have an image of a face and you go to this company, let's just call it Face Inc., and you go to their lobby and you just say to them, I want you to confirm if this image has a face on it. And so, yeah, they say, take it and come back in a few hours. We'll give you an answer. And so all the low-level employees get this image, and each employee is responsible for looking at a pixel or a cluster of pixels. And they say, oh, okay, based on these pixels, I can see that there's a thick horizontal line, or based on these clusters of pixels, I can see that there is curvature in this area. And so they go to their supervisors, and each of the supervisors specialize in a specific facial feature. So one supervisor says, okay, based on what you told me, I think we see a left eye here. And based on what you guys told me, I can confirm that I see a nostril here. And then all the supervisors then get together and they go to their boss, a single boss. The boss asks, okay, do you have a left eye? And someone says yes. And he asks the other supervisor, do you have a right eye? And somebody says yes. And then he asks the third supervisor, do you see a nose? And some guy says yes. And he asks the last employee, do you see a mouth? But the last guy says no. But he's saying, oh, okay, but we do have 3 out of the 4 features. So let's just say it's a face to be safe. And then the boss meets you in the lobby and says, we're pretty sure that this is a face. You look at the photo and you say, no, this was actually a photo of a dog. You're wrong. And then the boss goes back to the company and he says, oh, we did a terrible job. We need to improve our performance. And so the whole process starts over again. And so, yeah, it's this hierarchical learning process. You're creating a mathematical model of the different key features within an information space, and then it tries to generate an output that can reconstruct the learned features from the information you've given it. The application of artificial intelligence is to automate any mental processes. And so, of course, humans can quickly identify if an image has a face or not. But then if you have, 100,000 photos, an algorithm won't complain.
Automatic data processing. Automatic data processing.
Automatic data processing.
Automatic data processing.
Automatic data processing.
Automatic data processing.
Automatic data processing.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
a world of doubt.
The podcast about
the unknown.
When you were hiring a Richard Nixon, what were the traits that you were looking for?
It was actually quite hard to know. And this has been a process of discovery for Halsey and I, kind of what is the process of both visually transforming an actor into Richard Nixon and sonically as well. So the kind of cadence and the delivery needed to be similar. And then what we did was sat in a studio for 3 days, and we had collected about 8 hours, I think, of material of Richard Nixon giving speeches from the White House, and then just split them into clips of 1 to 3 seconds long. We were then given a kind of fairly simple web interface where we would play this to our actor. They would repeat them on a microphone, which would go into this web system. And then if we were happy, we thought it sounded similar, we would do the next one. And we did this over and over and over again, day after day, recording hundreds, I think probably thousands of clips. By the end of the 3 days, you then have two parallel data sets. You've got this list of clips of Nixon reading the speech, and then you've got Lewis Wheeler, who was our actor in the end, doing his best not to impersonate, but to do similar takes of these tiny, tiny little clips.
I have noted, for example, that a Republican senator...
One more time.
I have noted, for example, that a Republican senator.
Great.
Yeah.
I think I had a burr in my throat there on that.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I have noted, for example, that a Republican senator.
I'm Francesca Panetta. I'm creative director in the Center for Advanced Virtuality at MIT, and I am one of the directors of In Event of Moon Disaster.
Hi, I'm Halsey Burgund. I'm an independent sound artist and technologist, and I am the other director, co-director of In Event of Moon Disaster.
The project, well, its attempt is to make people more aware of the types of misinformation like deepfake technologies, but by doing it through a creative means. So we are making this project around the contingency speech that was written for Richard Nixon if the astronauts of the Apollo 11 mission had been left on the moon and not been able to return, which there was a possibility that would happen. His speechwriter, Bill Sapphire, wrote Richard Nixon a speech in case that would happen. It's this very beautiful elegy that he would have delivered if that had happened. So what we're doing is creating a whole kind of story around this alternative version of history It's going to be an installation. So we're going to create a living room set in 1969, the night of the moon landing. And you'll be invited to sit down and watch the television. In fact, some of it will be Walter Cronkite, Apollo 11 footage, and some real footage of Richard Nixon. And part of this project will be a deep fake of Richard Nixon reading this contingency speech from the Oval Office in the White House.
Man is about to launch himself on a trip to the moon, the expectation of landing there.
1-0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
The idea is that we change a few things and create a scenario where that contingency speech would, in fact, need to be delivered. So in our alternative history, the Apollo 11 rocket takes off just like it normally does. It circles the Earth a couple times and slingshots out to the moon. It starts orbiting, and then they want to descend to the moon. But on that descent, something happens which makes it impossible for them to come back after they've landed. So the speech was written in such a way that it was effectively, at least our interpretation of it at this point seems to be that it was written so that it was to be delivered when the Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong were actually still on the moon but knew that they could not get off. So they, in fact, could almost be listening to this speech in real time, and it refers to things like widows-to-be and whatnot. So it's this amazing kind of transitional moment where they know that they're not going to come home. They've done this amazing thing. And there's this, like this elegy, as Franz said, to their exploration and their hopes to give mankind overall some kind of, you know, future hope for exploration. So we have been working with several external companies to help us produce this. One of the companies we are working with is called Vocal ID. They're a voice synthesis company, so they create synthesized voices. And the purpose of creating the synthesized voices for them is primarily to give people who don't have a voice a voice. Either there's a biological problem with their anatomy somehow that they can't speak, and them typing and delivering a, you know, an audible voice would be very useful. There are also situations where people are so nervous, or maybe they're on the autistic spectrum or something, where they have a very hard time socially interacting with people because of, you know, an inability to speak in that sense. And then typing something out and having a system deliver it is much more comfortable for them. So the notion of allowing people like that to have a voice that is unique to them, just like all of us have, we have our own unique voice, but that they can control in this different way is extremely beneficial in a lot of these situations. So that to me is an amazingly positive and wonderful sort of use of voice synthesis technology, which, you know, wouldn't have been possible not that many years ago.
So now what happens?
I think you have to hit the play button. Okay, here we go.
I would like to tell everyone who donated their voice, thank you and I love you.
Oh, wow. This is the first time you've spoken in years.
Friend, can you talk to the downsides of it?
Yeah, I mean, making someone do something that they haven't consented to either do or say is deeply problematic. And at the moment, we're seeing this in areas of pornography and politics. I mean, we're seeing quite a lot of kind of comedy and humor too. But those two areas are the ones that are most concerning at the moment. And as we come up to the 2020 elections, that this kind of technology could be a problem.
I'm George W. Bush. During the 9/11 attacks on America, I just stared in disbelief.
I'm Barack Obama. During the G20 summit in China, I stared down Vladimir Putin.
I'm Donald Trump. During the solar eclipse, I stared directly at the sun.
I mean, one thing that this makes me think about is, like, it seems like every time we have new technology come out, There's a handful of people that say, wow, this is wonderful. Like, we need more of this. And there's a handful of people that say it's a slippery slope. and we're going to erode the fabric of society. And, you know, it's like, I can't tell like how concerning this actually is, you know, because we've been here before with tons of other technology.
Essentially every technology that comes out has, you know, positive and negative aspects to it. And over time, when we get more and more used to it, the society sort of seems to adapt. But perhaps the biggest issue with deepfakes right now is that we're on the sort of cusp of this. And there's this transitional time when things are changing and society does take a little while to catch up.
Yeah, I think that if you actually look at what is causing the most misinformation at the moment, it's not deepfakes. It's editing things in a certain way. It's shooting film or photography with a certain angle. Joan Donovan writes about how we place too much of an importance on these kind of visual elements as testimonies. So, you know, are they slowed down? Are they shot in a particular way? Are they, you know, is material edited? And so I think that maybe saying that deepfakes are so very, very different from what we've had previously doesn't mean it's not problematic, but I think that having that kind of wider skepticism is important.
You're arguing for, regardless of deepfakes, like an increased skepticism of anyone who tells you that they have reality in their fingertips and they can share it with you.
Yeah, because it's all perspective. You know, we still like to believe that what we see is real. Media that we create has always got a perspective. Different people have got different truths. In Israel and in Palestine, they have different truths. There's not one that is truer than another. Being aware of perspective within all of this is really important. I do know that deceiving people, and I'm quite clear on what I think are strong moral ethics, and I think that doing harm to people, deceiving them, lying to them, is pretty clear to me that is not okay.
I don't know. I've kind of wondered if most people are in the same camp as me. It's like kind of, I like it when someone calmly explains to me how the world is a little bit.
It's pretty reassuring.
Yeah, yeah. And that you can be like, okay, like they've got figured out. Someone's driving the ship. We aren't all just like hurtling through space on a rock that isn't really being driven. You know, it seems much more perilous at that point. You feel adrift when no one can tell you what reality is. I don't know.
You know, this idea of having this numerous methods of misinformation at the moment, what it creates is no consensus of anything and a world of doubt. And if everyone is doubting everything, then it kind of renders populations kind of inactive, because if you've got nothing to hold on to, if nothing is stable, then you kind of sit on the sidelines and you watch. And it means that certain types of leaders will come into power, and it means that it's harder to mobilize. It's harder, you become very kind of atomized, because, you know, this takes us back to this idea around deep fakes and misinformation, that if you create a culture of doubt where everything you see, everything you hear is possibly unreal, then it takes away all of our agency, because, you know, where are you in that kind of shifting landscape of unreality?
Good evening, my fellow Americans. Fate has ordained that the men who went to the moon to explore in peace will stay on the moon to rest in peace.
These brave men, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, know that there is no hope for their recovery. But they also know that there is hope for mankind in their sacrifice. These two men are laying down their lives in mankind's most noble goal, the search for truth and understanding. They will be mourned by their families and friends. They will be mourned by their nation. They will be mourned by the people of the world. They will be mourned by a Mother Earth that dared send two of her sons into the unknown. In their exploration, They stirred the people of the world to feel as one. In their sacrifice, they bind more tightly the brotherhood of man. In ancient days, men looked at the stars and saw their heroes in the constellations. In modern times, we do much the same, but our heroes are epic men of flesh and blood. Others will follow and surely find their way home. Man's search will not be denied. But these men were the first, and they will remain the foremost in our hearts.
For every human being who looks up at the moon in the nights to come will know that there is some corner of another world that is forever mankind. Good night.
Francesca Panetta and Halsey Burgund are the directors of In Event of Moon Disaster, an art installation which is currently debuting at International Documentary Festival Amsterdam. The project is supported by MIT's Open Documentary Lab and the Mozilla Foundation. Sometime in the spring of 2020, Francesca and Halsey will rework the project into a website. We'll be sure to let you know about it then. But in the meantime, you can watch a short clip of the deepfaked Nixon over on our website, hbmpodcast.com. Now, at the top of this episode, you heard a very out-of-context clip of an AI voice kind of losing its mind. That clip came from a paper called Location Relative Attention Mechanisms for Robust Long-Form Speech Synthesis. And one of the co-authors of that paper, RJ Scary Ryan, gave us permission to share some of those excerpts. And I think there's something so delightful about that AI getting hung up on a single syllable and then devolving into madness. So I'm just going to play another one of those examples for you after the credits end. There's definitely a ton more of these, though. And you can find the link to all of those audio examples on our website, which again is hbmpodcast.com. Another big thank you to Anjali Zuperis, who set up an interface for me to train my own deep-learned voice model, which is what you heard at the very beginning of the show, saying our KCRW header. And that voice is based off of the LJ voice dataset, which is compiled from over 20 hours of public domain audiobooks and generated by Keith Ito's implementation of Tacotron, which is a deep learning algorithm that works via TensorFlow. I actually just wanted to say all that so I could sound smart for a second because I talked to so many smart people for this episode. I was feeling left out. But I'm only actually about 80% sure that I got all that right, so feel free to at me on Twitter with your opinions. The cool thing about that voice, though, is that now that it's all trained up, I can make it say anything now. Things that I, personally, being a very mature adult, would never actually say myself. Words like fart.
Fart.
Or badger mouth parts.
Badger mouth parts.
Or just some long series of unintelligible vowels. My name is Jeff Entman. I produce this episode with help from Bethany Denton. Music on this episode by The Black Spot. Here Be Monsters is distributed by KCRW. Our senior editor there is Kristen Lepore. We get additional support for freelance contributions from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Please consider rating and reviewing Here Be Monsters on your favorite podcast platform, and also please consider using the things that you've learned on Here Be Monsters as a way to diffuse your awkward conversations at the Thanksgiving dinner table. Okay, thanks for listening. More episodes soon.
October, I read. Thank you.
Thank you.